This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Equity Mind.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. I'm excited for this episode. We always talk about how more and more investing can be truly global. Us as retail investors have more and more access around the world. The great news is that podcasting is also truly global, and we have the opportunity to speak to experts all around the world. And I'm very excited for this one because we've got someone joining us all the way from Malta.
Love it. Well, it is our pleasure to welcome Daniel Gladys to the show. Daniel, welcome.
Yeah. Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
Not a problem. We are excited for this one. And if you haven't come across Daniel before, he's the founder of Vltava Fund, a value-focused, research-driven hedge fund launched in 2004. Making it the oldest hedge fund in Central Europe. So plenty to unpack there. We first came across Daniel through his recent shareholder letter titled What Oil Prices Are Telling Us. So we're going to be unpacking all of that in today's episode, as well as Daniel's thoughts on current market conditions, inflation. There's just so much to chat about. But Daniel, the way we like to start our interviews is with an introduction to yourself. And we like to understand the story of our guest's first investment. So if you think back to when you first started thinking about investing and putting your money to work, can you share the story of your first investment?
I would have to go back about 30 years in my memories. So it's actually an interesting story. I spent 21 years of my life, the first 21 years, living in a communist country, in a country that was called Czechoslovakia then. So you can imagine there was almost no private ownership, no private property, no business, no stock market, no exchange, no investments. None of these things existed or even crossed our minds. But then in 1989, the Berlin Wall fell down and communism collapsed. And a couple of years later, we had a large stock exchange up in Prague, and it was all new, exciting world open up for us. And so I took my student savings that I got from picking fruit and stuff like that on farms, and bought my first investment portfolio. And then from the moment I was completely hooked, I had no idea what I was doing, that's true, but our market had a big boom just when I entered it, so it made it easier. But then in the same year, in 1993, we started a brokerage company with two of my friends, and it became the member of the Prague Stock Exchange, and we focused on institutional investors, and I was serving the foreign investors. So I had customers like Jeremy Grantham's GMO or Baupost, and then when I was visiting them in the US and in London, I listened to their stories and how they invest around the world, and it became immediately clear to me that I don't want to be a broker. I want to be, so to speak, on the other side of the phone, you know, someone who's running the money. So a couple of years later, we sold a brokerage company, and I became a portfolio manager. And about 18 years ago, we started Vatava Fund, and here we are. Still today.
So. Here we are, Daniel. We've interviewed a number of...
Long time ago.
We've interviewed a lot of people over the years, but I can say that's the first time someone has had the end of communism in Europe and you know, a stock exchange opening as the start of their very first investment. I can only imagine what how exciting and how different it must have been. But look, you've been running this hedge fund since 2004. You've seen a lot of different market conditions over that time. Have you developed a personal investing philosophy?
Yes, we have. The philosophy remains pretty much the same. What has been changing over time is how I describe it. Okay? So my current description goes like this. You know, I tend to see companies as entities where people create value. You know, with their effort, with their work, with their ideas, you know, with their risk taking, etc. And that value creation in the combination with the capital that the companies have at their disposal and the investment rates that they can reinvest in, creates a lot of value. And I just want to be part of it, you know. So that's a simple story, but this is how we describe it right now. So we're looking for companies that we think we understand, that have a lot of that human factor, and that also have a high returns on capital, because that pretty much is a necessity if you want to look for something that where really value is being created at a high speed.
Yeah, I love that idea of a company is just a vehicle for people to create value. And one of your shareholder letters that we'll touch on a little bit later, titled "Please Allow Me to Introduce," you talk about a number of those people leading the companies that you're investing in. But before we get there, you have also written two books, Learn to Invest and Stock Investments. Everyone should go and pick up those books. But for people listening who have, this is the first time they've come across you, what are some of the, I guess, the key lessons or the key takeaways that you're really trying to get across to people in those books?
The key takeaways would be that as an investor, you only really needs to master two things. One is to know how to value a business, because you always have to think in two different terms, price and value. You know, you should be trying to buy something for less than it's worth. So the price should be less than the value. So you should have some understanding of what the value is. And that applies for all kinds of investments, not just equities. You know, it can be private equity, it can be real estate, it can be anything, you know. And then the other thing you need to master is how to handle or how to approach market movements. You know, so it has to something to do with your own psychology, your own discipline, having long-term view, etc. So that would be the key takeaway. And the second book is more or less extension of the first one, and also talks more about the current investment environment we are living in. That is environment of, you know, long-term negative real interest rates and environment where money are losing its purchasing power faster than before, and how to adapt to that, you know.
Mm. Well, speaking of the current environment we're in, we're really interested to get your thoughts on oil specifically. So let's leave that for a conversation in a moment. How would you sum the current environment that we're in at the moment? You know, a lot of macro headwinds that we're coming into, inflation, interest rates. If you were to sort of take a few moments to, summarize or give us your thoughts on the current environment that we're facing at the moment.
I think the key to everything is to realize that whatever happens, we're probably going to have real negative interest rates for a very long time. You know? Because in the past, usually when there was a high inflation, we have to go quite way back in the developed markets. It was usually accompanied by very high interest rates, and usually interest rates higher than inflation rates. While this time, we have quite high inflation everywhere, but the interest rates still remain extremely low. You know, so that's an unparalleled environment, and it would probably remain like that because the leverage in the system, especially at the level of governments, is so high that most of governments are not able to sustain high interest rates. So we're going to have an environment where the money debasement basically continue faster and faster because you know, the money will be losing its value. So that's that basically, if you look around for you know, and consider various investment opportunities, it completely disqualifies all fixed income assets, basically, right? Because anything you buy, you're guaranteed to make loss in real terms. Mm-hmm. So you have to look only basically into assets where you own something, own some property, own some equity that is able to create value and compensate at least partially for the money debasement. So that's that. And of course, this is a long-term view, but currently there are many other uncertainties, you know, that the inflation is too high, you know, too fast. You have a lot of disruptions still on the supply side, both from the COVID and both from the war. There's an energy crisis brewing all around the world, which we might talk about later. So there's a lot of uncertainties, but there's always uncertainties in the market. You will never reach a point where you would be able to say, okay, right now we have no uncertainties. You know? So that's I think pretty normal anyway.
That would be nice.
That would be very nice.
Well, if people think that we are in a situation where there's actually no risk on the horizon, then probably the asset would be extremely expensive because that would be already showing the prices. And so you cannot expect to have low prices and blue sky at the same time. You know? So,
yeah, we'll touch on the energy situation in a minute and about your investor letter, what oil prices are telling us. Before we get there, it must be quite an interesting time in Europe. Interesting might not be the right word, but the European Central Bank looking at raising interest rates for the first time in 11 years, at the same time concerns that about Italy's debt in particular and what higher interest rates could lead to. The whole Russia-Ukraine situation, Germany's reliance on Russian gas situation aside, it feels like there are other crises brewing in Europe as well. How do you see it from the continent?
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
Euro as a common currency for many states is really a problem because you have one central bank, European Central Bank, that still keeps interest rates at -0.5%, right? Then you have countries like Italy or Spain where inflation is like 10%, but you also have countries like Estonia that is using euros and have heavy inflation at 20%. Mm. And they still have -0.5% interest rates and they can do nothing about it because they cannot raise interest rates. They cannot, you know, change exchange rate, you know, anyhow, because they don't have their own currency. So it's totally, I think it's unworkable. And then you have the ECB still hasn't started raising rates despite the fact that the Eurozone inflation is over 9%. And Italy is already complaining about high fixed income rates or high bond rates. So this is really insane. So the only thing that the ECB has come up with recently is that they will stop buying bonds from the better countries, so Germany and maybe Netherlands, but they will keep buying the bonds from the weaker countries. So that's totally insane. So, but there's nothing the individual countries can do about it. But then at the same time, you have the war here in Ukraine, which is terrible. And of course, Russia is using oil and gas, especially gas, as their weapon. You know, they stop supplying gas now in summer where it's not a problem. But if they stop supplying for another 6 months, it might be a big problem in winter because people will be cold. And at the same time, in Germany, there's still this green idea, this green thinking going on. They're still going to switch off their last remaining nuclear power station at the end of the year. So, you know, this is making the whole situation even worse. So, but as an investor, you can do many things. You can ignore Europe. I mean, you can invest in other parts of the world. You can hedge the currencies. You know, you can short. You know, you can try to buy European companies, which are really global companies. So there's many ways around that. But still, it's from the macro point of view, it's very, very complicated.
Mm.
So, Daniel, you've written the letter that we want to chat to you about today, all around the price of oil and the impact that it's going to have, called What Oil Prices Are Telling Us. So let's start with the here and now. I think oil price, a barrel of crude, is about $100 a barrel. Correct me if I'm wrong. It has been up as high as about $140 over the last few months. What is the current, like, is this a high price for a price of oil, a barrel right now? What's the state of oil right now?
Well, for people that got used to oil around 50 or 60s in the last 2 or 3 years, 100, 110 may seem high, okay? But 2008 was 140. But if you adjust it for inflation, you know, the oil would have to go nearly to 200 today to be at the same level, you know, adjusted for inflation. So it can still go much, much higher. And I'm afraid it will go much higher, because that's where our analysis of supply and demand lead us. You know.
Yeah, and so on the supply and demand point, there's been a lot of commentary about the underinvestment in the 2010s from the oil companies. Is that the key reason why you think it could go higher, or what are the other factors that you think?
On the demand side, you have currently 101 million or 102 million of barrels consumed every day. So that's the current state of the demand. The demand can move up around, you know, it can drop in recession. It dropped a lot for a couple of quarters in 2020 when the whole world shut down. But generally, it tends to rise about 1% every year. So you can think of another million barrel per day next year, another one next year. And because a lot of people think naively that we will not need much more oil very soon, you know, but these people tend to live in places like Germany and California, but they forget that the world is actually more China and India and Latin America and Africa. The people there are much poorer, and they also want to have more comfortable life. You know, they want to, you know, have more, want to become richer. And, you know, if they do, and I wish them to do so, then their energy consumption would grow much, much higher, because they still consume a fraction of what the West consumes. And very large part of that would be from fossil fuels, including oil. So you can expect that the demand will continue rising. Now, on the supply side, the thing is that the oil companies would love to produce more, but they're basically being told that they are evil because they're producing oil. Okay, so while in the previous peak in 2008, every oil company was trying to drill and drill and drill and acquire assets and acquire other companies and grow, and they grew too much. Right now, they don't want to invest because it makes life harder for them, because the governments, the politicians, very often their own shareholders are pushing them to lower emissions. So they say to themselves, okay, so why would we make life harder for us? You know, let's just use the free cash flow and pay to shareholders. And basically they don't invest enough. And if you look at the amount of investments that went into the oil sector in the last 5 or 7 years, it's been declining, and actually is at historical lows, or 15-year low. And it's sufficient, that's simply not enough to sustain the current level of production, because you have a depletion of oil production, you know, like 3 to 6% every year. So you need to invest a lot of money just to stay at the same level of production, you know, let alone to increase it. So that's where we are. And it's also important to know that, to realize that the supply can react, the supply side, but the reaction time is very long. You know, if you start increasing your investments into new development and production today, you will not see anything within 12 months, okay? You will need 2, 3, 4 years to see something. So basically, companies need to see much higher oil price for longer, convince themselves that they want to invest.
Mm.
So that's
And so that's the supply side. You know, they need to be confident of higher prices, that the higher prices will last. And then there's the time lag while they get oil production up and running. So then the question turns to the demand side, and this is where the term demand destruction comes in. And, you know, oil is, it's pretty inelastic. People, the demand hasn't really softened as it, you know, sits over $100 a barrel. How do you think about the demand side and where we might start seeing demand fall off?
The demand side is, the demand curve is very inelastic, as you said. And in 2008, when oil was 140, we still didn't see any demand destruction. And I don't think we see it yet. And that's despite the fact that actually the gas prices, I mean, for cars, are actually much higher than the oil would suggest, because they also reflect the refining margins, which are also at record high, because you just don't have enough refineries, because no one would let any to be built. So we don't see any demand destruction. It's also important to realize that only a smaller part of oil is actually used for transportation. You know, they're always used for other things, for energy generation. And right now in Europe, when Russia stops supplying gas, some power stations will be switching from gas to oil. So it's actually quite bullish for oil. Then oil is also used for plastics. I mean, I don't know what you're wearing, but I bet that it's made from gas or oil. You know, it's every fiber, every plastic. Medicine, fertilizers, you know, there's a lot of uses for oil that the world cannot live without, you know. So I don't see any demand destruction happening anytime soon.
Big bull case for oil.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, there's one of the headings in your letter is politicians are making the whole situation still worse. So can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, it's basically what I said. You know, the green agendas are basically pushing oil companies not to produce. Okay, so that the hurdles are quite high for them, you know, to overcome. Also, the governments are coming with brilliant ideas like windfall tax. Okay, on oil companies, because they think that their profits today are unjustified. But if you want lower oil prices, what you need first, you need to have a lot of profits for oil companies so that they can invest, okay? If you tax that money away right now, then they will not invest, you know? So this is not going to decrease oil price. And at the same time, they're subsidizing the demand, you know, because they see that, you know, gas, you know, petrol is expensive and heating is expensive. So they're basically giving out subsidies to consumers, which perversely is you know, delaying the demand destruction. So that's the whole situation is making it even worse, you know. So that it's a very difficult environment for all companies to deal. You know, I'm no fanatic for fossil fuels. You know, it's not, I'm not talking about what I wish to happen, because I think it's important to realize that investing is not about what you wish to happen, but what you think will happen. And these can be completely two different things. So no, I also want oil to go lower. I want living to be cheaper. I want the environment to be cleaner. But the world doesn't care what I wish, you know. So I should invest reflecting what I think will happen and what I wish to happen. So this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it is a funny situation we found ourselves in this year. For years, ESG investing was the biggest buzzword and the hottest part of the market. And all of a sudden, everyone realized that the transition hasn't happened yet. And oil and, you know, we're in Australia and coal companies are some of the best performers of this year. And it's not because people say the future there. It's just because we're still in 2020.
No, I think the politicians have totally wrong vision of how fast things can change, you know, and if you just push too hard, it will be counterproductive. This is what we're seeing right now, I think, because part of these high oil prices are definitely driven by the green policies.
So, Daniel, I think we've spoken enough about oil. We want to move on to some of the other positions in your portfolio, but before we do, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Daniel, before the break, we spoke about the price of oil, what we can learn from it, where it's going, all really based around one of your investor letters, what oil prices are telling us. If people want to go and read that letter, they can read it on your website. But there was another investor letter we came across titled, Please Allow Me to Introduce. And we thought this was a great introduction to some of the bigger holdings in your portfolio. The premise of the letter is really, it aligns with the investment philosophy you introduced earlier about, people creating this value and trying to find the best executives and the best entrepreneurs and being involved in their value creation. You step through some of the names of your list on your list, and there's some really well-known, I guess, managers, Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan, Warren Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway, and then a number of great entrepreneurs that we haven't, or that we're not as familiar with here in Australia, at least. So let's start with the two that we know quite well, and then we'll move to some of these other companies that we don't know as well. Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan. Why are these companies big parts of your portfolio, and why do you love the managers?
Well, Warren Buffett, it's hard to come up with something that wasn't said about him, you know. When I was younger, I had a rock band and I wrote all the songs, you know. And it's often when you want to write a song, it's you always realize that Bob Dylan has already written something like that. You know? So whenever I talk about investing, I always realize that Buffett is already said something like that before, you know. So he's an absolute legend. You know, I mean, his performance is totally, totally amazing. He basically started from zero and grown company to today's size. You know, he made many people rich during 60 years. He inspired many investors. You know, he wrote a lot about what he's doing. So he's an excellent teacher. And he wants to give all his money to charity, you know. So this is one of the best stories ever in the investment world. And his track record is now 67 years, and it's probably over 20% per annum. So there's absolutely no one that can compare. So I'm extremely happy to be a long-term shareholder of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, because not only because this is a great conglomerate, great collection of businesses which are undervalued and present quite low business risk, but also the idea that all these people are working for me, you know, literally, is just fantastic, you know. So this is the way I tend to think about buying companies. You know, if I buy JP Morgan with Jamie Dimon on the top of it, he's working for me, you know. And even if I sleep, he's still working for me, you know. So It's pretty good, and he's also an amazing man. I mean, he's been with the company for many years. Actually, he came before from the Bank One. You know, he became CEO of that company, and he's been running JP Morgan for many years. He's by far the strongest and the best bank, universal bank in the world. And I'm just amazed every time by the power. I like a lot of companies in the financial sector, because that's where I spent my 30 years of my career in working. So I feel I have a good understanding of banks, of insurance companies, of various specialty finance companies, etc. And most of the businesses are really driven by people. I mean, just the investment business that we are in. Basically, a fund is a commodity product. I mean, whatever everyone says, basically it's a commodity product, and there's a huge competition, and it is extremely difficult to differentiate yourself from the competitors. But there are some that are much better than others, and they continue to be much better. So it must be it must be because of their human skills, you know. So that's why I always like companies with good people on the top. And if I look at in our portfolio, we have about 20 or 22 stocks in the portfolio, and I would say at least half of them are run by founders or people that have very large portion of their own wealth in the business. So they have definitely their skin in the game, and also they see the business as their own baby. I mean, Buffett has created Berkshire from nothing, basically. So he definitely runs it with his best effort, which is not something that is automatic in every company. Mm.
So many words of wisdom in that. I loved it. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So one another company that so that was Berkshire and JP Morgan. A couple of other companies we want to touch on that the community might not have heard of, and I haven't heard of this one. And forgive me if I get the pronunciation wrong. Alimentation Couche-Tard, Canadian convenience chain. Is that correct?
Yes.
Nice. Nailed it. So, why is that in your portfolio? Do you have the same approach from a, you know, is it founder led? Is it the people? Can you tell?
Yes, it's one of the most fascinating Canadian growth stories of last 30 years or so. The company is was started by a gentleman called Alain Bouchard in the French part of Canada. He started by opening one convenience store, right? And today the company has, I think, 17,000 convenience stores and petrol stations in Canada, US, in Europe, and some in Asia. And it's extremely well-run business, completely driven by the management, by the philosophy, and I just love being part of it. You know, it's extremely well-run company.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I think in your letter you said he came up with the idea of keeping a store open 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
Big innovation. Yeah. It's funny.
Spawned 7-Eleven.
Yeah, it's funny in hindsight, like so many, because Bryce and I both have a retail background. We worked at the two largest supermarkets in Australia, and so many of the innovations in hindsight look so obvious, but it still takes someone to to come and do it. I know the biggest retail award, one of the biggest retail awards in Australia, is named after the guy that introduced shopping trolleys. And it's like, in hindsight, well, of course that was going to be a thing, but similar to this 24 hours a day thing, it still takes someone to actually do it. Another company that you did hold, I'm not sure if you still do, is it Sberbank, the Russian bank?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the company? Obviously, with everything going on in Russia at the moment, is it still a company that you like? What are your thoughts on it halfway through 2022?
Yeah, it's a very, very exciting story with a very unfortunate ending, at least so far. You know, I first actually was a bear market myself at the end of 1996 when it was still a post-communist dinosaur. And I've been following the company ever since. And in 2007, a gentleman called Herman Greth became CEO, and he actually turned the bank into probably the best bank in Europe, I think, right? It was extremely profitable, totally dominant position in Russia. You know, it's perfect corporate governance, extremely shareholder-friendly, technologically very advanced. And we owned the stock for like 6 or 7 or 8 years. And it was performing extremely well. But then when it became clear to us in the beginning of this year that Russia is going to invade Ukraine, we took profit and sold the stock, and because we didn't want to have anything to do with Russia. And so that's like the sad ending of the story so far. You know, so the company is extremely good, but unfortunately it's in a country where the government went crazy and basically destroyed half of the business. So I don't know what the management thinks about it, but if you can imagine that the CEO spent the last 14 years or 13 years creating this business, which was now half killed, I don't think he's very happy, but there's nothing he can do. So, so it's also important to think that you should also be flexible with what you do, because you can have, very often people fall in love with companies they own, and we do as well. But things change, and when things change, you have to change your thinking as well. And in this case, the change was very quick and very dramatic, and we just decided to get out and we're happy not to have anything to do with Russia anymore.
Mm. So, Daniel, another company that's one of your top holdings, I believe, is Magna. Is it Magna International? Can you tell us what the company does and the thesis behind
it? Yeah, I hadn't heard of this one before I read. Yeah.
No. Magna is an automotive car supplier, probably one of the top three in the world. It's actually probably the only company in the world that can create, design, assemble, manufacture the whole car from the beginning to the end. And it's based in Canada. Again, it's an interesting story. It was founded several decades ago by an Austrian gentleman from Austria, Frank Stronach, who moved to Canada. And again, from one garage shop, he built the company into, I don't know, $40 billion or $45 billion of sales, you know, so very large. He's not running anymore because he's, I think he might be 85 or 90 now. So he left 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But the company is still doing very well, and we like it quite a lot. You know, it's a cyclical business, but you know, over the cycle, I think it's doing very well.
Nice. So, Daniel, before we move to our final three questions, I've just got another question. Obviously, we've spent the first half of this discussion talking about the macro headwinds and a lot on the oil price and where it's going and the implications on inflation and all of those sorts of things. And then we've spent the second half of the interview talking about some of the positions in your portfolio and the investment philosophy that you take from founder-led companies and having a longer-term vision. For someone who's listening at home and starting their investing journey and looking at all the headlines around inflation and oil price, but then hearing about how you actually invest, does everything around oil and all of that, should it be something that we're focusing on? Does it really matter? What should be the sort of takeaway from that half of the conversation versus actually taking a long-term investing approach?
One takeaway can be that investors should look way beyond the horizon of the current events, because they will end, they will change, new things will come up. And I think there's a long-term investment horizon. Many of these things can be ignored, right? So investment horizon should be sufficiently long, and with that sort of approach, you should be looking or picking investments. I mean, our largest investment is Berkshire Hathaway, and we've owned it for 11 years probably, and we'll probably own it for another 11 years, you know, if the fate allows us. And I'm sure that during the last 18 years, just think what happened. You know, many things happened and was quite terrible, including COVID. You know, everything shut down globally overnight, which is totally unexpected. But the company survived. You know, the stock price is probably four times as high as we bought it in the first place. And I mean, the next 10, 11 years will also bring many things that we cannot envision today. But I'm sure it will do quite well and will be much higher 10 years from now. So this is the way I prefer to look at stocks. Always look beyond the current horizons, because it's completely unpredictable. Just think 6 months or 9 months back, you know, and would you say a year ago that the inflation when at that time was 2% would be 10% now? Or would you say that the oil price would double, or gas prices would quintuple in Europe, or that Russia would invade Ukraine? I mean, none of these things would probably come to your mind. And if you think about next 3 or 5 years, it's going to be the same, you know. So I think that might be the takeaway.
Mm. Yeah,
good takeaway.
Yeah, it's a good takeaway. I think a second takeaway I have for this interview, Daniel, as we move towards our final three questions, is just a reminder that there are great companies and great entrepreneurs everywhere in the world. Of the five companies we spoke about, two are in the States, two are in Canada, one's in Europe, and there's also great investors everywhere in the world. And we want to say a massive thank you for you sharing your time with us. And I think it's about 6 a.m. Over where you are, so we appreciate you getting up early and joining us on the show. If people want to find out more about you, they can go to the website, and it's apologies if I get the pronunciation wrong, Vltava, VLTAVA. Rotava.com. So go and read the investor letters.
We've it's actually Rotava Fund.
I was thinking so much about the pronunciation, I got the URL wrong. But yeah, people can go and read the investor letters that we've been speaking about today. And there's plenty more that you've written there as well. But Daniel, we'll move to the final three questions. And the first one is, do you have any books that you consider must read?
Yes, I made a list of six. I just go quickly through them. I think everyone should read Graham's Intelligent Investor, especially chapters 8 and 20 should be read again and again and again. Then Berkshire Hathaway's letters to investors that were published as a book are absolutely absolute treasure. Then regarding the psychology, Robert Shiller and his Rational Exuberance is excellent. And quite old book from 19th century, called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay, is absolutely fantastic. And about the cycles, Howard Marks, The Most Important Thing, I would recommend. And on valuation, anything written by Mr. Damodaran. You know, he wrote several books on valuation, so you pick up any of them, basically, and that should help you
value
the businesses.
That's they're six great books. Yeah. I think any investor would do very well if they read all six of those. The second question, Daniel, forget valuation or what a company looks like as an investment opportunity today, just purely based on the company's fundamentals. What's the best company you've ever come across?
It's a Berkshire Hathaway. If you tell me I have to put all my assets in one stock and go away for 5 or 7 years and not touch it, this would be the one that I would choose.
Nice. And is it because of the people, or is it anything about the structure of the business as well?
No, it's the people, the structure of business, the mold that it has, and the valuation currently. So everything is in favor.
Love that. And then, Daniel, final question. If you think back to your younger self, just starting out as an investor, opening up that brokerage as the Berlin Wall comes down, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Probably make things the most simple possible. I made mistakes quite often when I tried to prove how good I am, you know, frankly, and I tried to complicate things and overdo things and try to create something just totally unnecessary. And over time, I tended to making things in the most simple way, and it's probably the best. So that would be my advice.
I love that. I think we often try and remind ourselves that of, you know, particularly when it comes to investing, it's very easy to get caught up in things have to be different and complicated for it to be successful. Yeah. And sometimes the most simple, right in front of you approach is going to be the best outcome. So great way to finish, Daniel. And we seriously appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
I thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Thanks, Daniel.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Equity Mates. We love hearing from you, so drop us a line at contact@equitymates.com, or even better, go to your podcast player and leave a 5-star review. Also, a reminder that the Equity Mates content train doesn't stop when you've run out of episodes to binge. We've got a brand new website, a Facebook discussion group. We're on Instagram, YouTube, and slowly making our way as an influencer on TikTok. Well, that's Ren. So come and say hello and join the community. We'd love to welcome you. Until next time.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. Equity Mates gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by a range of financial service professionals. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Equity Mates Media does not operate under an Australian Financial Services License and relies on the exemption available under the Corporations Act 2001 in respect of any information or advice given. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast or video. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.